With us tonight is Chuck Lutz, the author of this book, Surprising Gift, and author of several other books. He has just recently served for, 6 years in the Office of Church and Society for the American Lutheran Church, and is now an interim director for the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches. And he knows much about Holden, and when he was up here this week, I asked Chuck if he could think of some sort of topic that he might want to talk about that might go against the grain of many Holden people. Because it's the hardest type of thing to find here at Holden, is somebody to do that, and if anybody could possibly do that, Chuck could. He said he'd give it some thought, and he came back the next day and says, I have a different idea. I don't know how different it is, but the topic...
Pretty the same idea.
I figured it would be. Demythologizing Holden. And I asked Chuck if he could present some opening statements about that theme, and then proceed as we normally do, in a form that a good form is when we all talk, argue, exchange ideas together. So that's what we hoped happens here. And if any of you do worry, we do stop at 10, 5 after at the extreme latest. So that I will call it at that time. And then if any of you want to stay around longer until the lights go out or later, you're more than welcome to do that. Chuck?
Thank you, Darius. When I was doing research for the book, Surprising Gift, over a year ago, I talked to a lot of people who had had some involvement with the village over the last 25, 26 years. And the more I talked with people who had a deep involvement with the village, usually people who'd been here more than just for a week, as volunteers for three weeks or more, or as people in a transition period who came here, I began to realize that Holden has a special kind of significance to a lot of people. In fact, the people I talked with were very concerned about how the book would be written, and they all had their opinions about how it should come out. And I felt as I was writing it that there were 40 or 50 people who were looking over my shoulder as I typed away on the word processor. But many people indicated that this place is special for them, and it's special in a way that no other place is. And it's not just the geography of the village they were talking about, but the community that is the village, and what they found here, the meaning that they found for their lives. That's important. I think the importance of Holden's special meaning for people is something we ought not knock, we ought not try to undermine or deny or talk away. What I'd like to do tonight, though, is talk about some particular concerns that I think come out of that very special love that people have for the village. Some of that I hint at in the book, but I want to develop it a little more than I did there. Ann Hafton, for example, whom many of you know, is on the board and was here, I think, in the early to mid-70s for the first time as a volunteer. Ann told me, and I quote her in the book, that this place not only is important to her, but was foundational in who she is, and who she is today, helping her to, as she put it, recover her identity in the church and her identity in relation to the Christian faith. Lots of people talk that way. I remember the 1976 bicentennial discussions about the meaning of America. Remember those? There was even a book by that title that I read. Well, what is the meaning of Holden? Porty Christman, a longtime Holdenite who is now deceased, said more than once, if we ever understood this place, we'd spoil it. And I think that's true, and I don't think we should try in rational terms to understand what it is that makes Holden work, what it is that makes Holden tick. But what I came up with in reflecting on that was that there is a mythology about Holden. And mythology is important in our lives. We all, to some degree or other, live by myths. Myths help to explain reality. Now, myths are not untruths. That meaning of myth, I don't want to use tonight. It is not something that is untrue. A myth is a symbolic meaning of something. When something has mythic proportions, it is somehow larger than life. It is larger than the reality that it points to. I think of the way sports writers talk about Babe Ruth in baseball as a mythic figure. Well, Holden has something of a mythic character about it for us. Now, when you demythologize, what you're doing is trying to divest the symbolic overtones and to get to the core meaning. I remember about 30 years ago, I first heard a poem, not unlike the poetry of Paul Hansen that we heard tonight, which talked about Bultmann, Rudolf Bultmann. Some of you may remember that name if you're old enough. His name isn't so big anymore. A German theologian who was big on demythologizing the scriptures. And the little poem went, "Hark the herald angels sing, Bultmann is the latest thing." At least they would if he had not demythologized the lot. So, demythologizing is trying to get to the core meaning and to remove all of the symbolic overtones. If we try to do that about Holden, what are we doing? Well, we could talk about de-romanticizing the place or desacralizing it, taking away the sacredness that we attach to it, or demystifying it, maybe taking away the mystery or the mystique of it. Anyway, I wish to suggest some concerns that result from the great love that people have for Holden, the larger-than-life meaning that it assumes in the lives of, I think, thousands of people. That's not a problem, I don't think. If it is a problem, it's a nice kind to have, the kind of problem that results from being overloved or giving over much love to a reality. Let me begin by suggesting that getting to Holden is a part of that mystique and that mythos. Getting to Holden is not easy. You have to want to come here. You don't just pull off the road and drop in. In fact, you don't even get here by road. Basically, you can't drive your car here. And for most Americans, that makes something almost supernatural. You can't drive your car there. There's something extra special, almost mystical about it. And I think that's part of what gives Holden the special character that it has for us. That geographic reality helps to invest Holden with a mythic character. The village even gets a certain theological interpretation by virtue of that transition from another world that it requires for us to get here. George Utek, friend of mine from way back. I went to Wartburg College with George. We were in the same class back in the 50s. Some of you may know him. He is a poet theologian who was up here in the early 60s. And George put it this way. He likened the trip to Holden Village to our baptism. He said it's like going through the waters. We are, he said, reborn, subconsciously prepared for a new life by that journey through the water. So the trip up Lake Chelan, George talked about in terms of a baptism, a rebirth. The time elapse, I think, between Chelan or Fields Point and arrival at the tailings, which is the first sign of the village for us, is an important element in that sense of otherness that we have about Holden. It's like a decompression chamber of several hours. And that works both ways. When you go back into the outside world, you also have a time of decompression. And we'll all experience that sooner or later when we leave here. Now, let me mention three specifics that I think are concerns that result from our strong attachment to the village. At least they are for me. If you don't share them, that's fine. But I'll tell you where my own biases are about these matters. Both as a place and as a community, now I'm speaking when I speak about Holden. The first is that we love it too much. And I get that language from Dan Erlander, who many of you know also. Dan says, and I quote him in the book, "Some people love Holden so much that they are over-possessive about the place and unwilling ever to have it change. They want it to remain the Holden that it was when they were here in the most meaningful experience they had here, or when they as they return every summer for an annual fix. They want it to be like it was back when they first became acquainted with Holden. He says that's a problem, and I think it is, because everything changes, including Holden Village. Everything evolves. It's almost like the disciples on the Mount of Transfiguration who wanted to either stay there or build a special a little booth, a tabernacle, to the experience they had there, and didn't want to return really to the plain below. A second kind of concern is that we try to transplant Holden to other settings. Various attempts have been made, and I think all have shown that it cannot be done. You cannot take Holden Village anywhere else. It is not the same thing. And maybe that tells us that we ought not try. But it's natural to want to try. There are many things from Holden and the experience we have here that we can take home and adapt into both our parish and our public settings. And we should do that. But Holden itself cannot be replicated elsewhere, I believe, and we should not be tempted to make the attempt. The third concern is that we sometimes behave like a Holden cult on the outside. Wherever there are large numbers of Holdenites, as in the Twin Cities of Minnesota, that's my experience, probably even in St. Cloud.
Especially Minnesota like this.
Well, yeah, and particularly in the Twin Cities where I've experienced it. The temptation is to hang out together. And I think that's understandable, and it's not wrong. But we can, and I think often do, give the impression of a kind of in-group, an elite, almost a mystery cult. To those who haven't been ushered into the mysteries of Holden, we look that way to them. A mystery cult of those who've had the privilege of time here. Now that's always a danger when experience changes our lives, as Holden does. But I think we need to beware the temptation to exhibit an attitude of what I would call Holdener than thou. Related to that is a cult of leadership. Elmer just came in. I remember one of the striking things as I worked on the book was the number of people who said, when the first permanent director, Carol Hinderly, left, or when it was announced that he was leaving, how can Holden survive without Carol Hinderly? I mean, you couldn't imagine it without Carol Hinderly. And of course, the truth is that the Holden of Carol Hinderly, exactly as it was under Carol's leadership, did not survive. It evolved. It changed. But much of what it was with Carol and his wife Mary continues to this day. There is evolution. But that was the immediate feeling that many people had back in 76, 78, 77. Holden Village can't go on without Carol Hinderly. Well, it has been demonstrated that it can go on without Carol, it can go on without John Schramm, it can go on without Elmer Witt. I think we will learn in the next period, hard as that is to believe. So there can also be at Holden, as there is with any profound experience that people have with a community or a place, and an identification with the leader, there can be a kind of cult of leadership that results. And I think we need to be aware of that. Now, to conclude, and then I very much enjoy having all of you talk about these things yourselves. With all of these concerns, and there are others that we could talk about, as with the life of the village in general, we need to retain a sense of humor. Not to be over serious about Holden. That's one thing that Carol Hinderly stressed over and over again. That we are able to laugh at ourselves and at Holden, and surely to laugh at our desire to make it a place where God dwells in some way that is quantitatively or qualitatively different than anywhere else in the world. That is not theologically supportable. And we need, when we are tempted to that thought, we need to be able to laugh at ourselves. Holden is special. I'd say it's unique. I think there is no other place like it in the world that I've ever known. It changes lives, and it is sacramental in its ability to be a channel for God's grace to people. but it is not ever, for any of us, our real world. Carol mentioned that tonight in her meditation. This is not the permanent abode of any of us, including staff who are here for the longest period of time. I think Werner Jansen still holds the record for about 21 or 2 years of service. But even for Werner, there came a time when he left Holden. It did not remain his permanent place until death. It is not ever for any of us our real world. It is renewal and it is refreshment for the day-to-day reality, which is our real world, and we honor the integrity of Holden when we keep it in that perspective. Thank you.
Well, at this point, we want to just open it up and see if you want to add some of your own demythologizing, or if you want to pick up on anything that Chuck might have said, or any stories you might want to share. I have one quick one. When my wife Cindy is awaiting word through the mail of whether or not she'll be employed when we return, and trying to get an interview the day before we left and try to explain to that principal at that school that there's no phone where we it just did not compute. This is in the United States of America.
Yeah, very much. A developed country. Yes. Yeah. I had that same experience when I said goodbye to my new staff of 1 month. I had just gotten acquainted with them, and I told them, where I'm going, you cannot reach me. They said, what? Then they said, we'll try to cope. And I think they will. But that frightens people when you tell, and family members, when they say, there's no way you can get to me quickly unless it's a really dire emergency, and then you use the radio service of the police department in Chelan. That too contributes to the specialness. I had suggested to Carol, that who's been here also almost from the beginning,
yeah.
63 or 2. Carol Nolte is a current board member, and her memory of the village goes way back at least 25 years. I suggested to her that she might have some thoughts on this subject. And maybe we could turn to her if she's willing.
Sure.
Speak up,
Carol.
I have
lots and lots of stories, but I was trying to think about what kind of demythologizing I've attempted in the past. Early on, we had this rush to collect relics.
Hmm.
And I can remember in 62, one of the things, we all worked together and we all did everything. Everybody washed the dishes, everybody made trail, everybody had Bible study, everybody did everything.
There was no guest staff distinction
then.
There
was nothing like that. And I can remember that Wes was going around and beginning his collection of relics. And he had collected out of several of the chalets sample rocks that had been thrown through the window by the vandals.
Sample rocks.
And it's all displayed. And a couple of us went around and threw those rocks out and put other rocks in.
Did you ever tell Wes?
No.
They're pretty.
So they're not real relics.
But if you touch them, you'll be healed.
If you touch them, you'll be killed.
Oh, when this son encouraged me 3 years ago to come along with them to Holden, I was told that it was a place apart. And I have found that it certainly was a place apart. And I still find it so when I'm here this week. And it's great to be here.
And the switchbacks weren't as scary this time, were they?
when we came up 3 years ago, after we got up here, I told him, you never told me that's kind of a mountain I had to climb. And he said he knew better than to tell me.
I think for me and for others who I've talked to over the years, one of the four demythologizing is that Holden isn't always an up place.
Isn't always an up place.
It can be a place of pain, of loneliness, of, you know, I think people going through transitions that might not be the easiest. And sometimes this isn't even the easiest place to be in transition. I think there's a different kind of myth that way, and you know, the traditional definition of myth.
That this will always be a place of healing, no matter what you hurt.
For some, and that
it's not
always easy, and some it's just not so, period.
Yeah.
For others, it's certainly the other end. It's been, and for me at times, I've experienced both here, where it's been a very lonely place, and other times it's been such a supportive place for me in those times. So that it's part of life in that way. I mean, it's not the catch-all end-all, but it certainly has fostered a lot of growth for me too.
One of the things that I think early on, it's got this reputation that this is the perfect place. And I remember somebody had an advertisement or some story about an advertisement that they cut out of a paper advertising a church camp, not here, but someplace in the Midwest. And the church advertisement read that this camp was 50 miles from any known form of sin.
That's funny.
We laugh about that a lot, but then one of the things that I think I've learned is that this place isn't a perfect place, and people are people, and forgiveness is necessary. And I think that it's here that I've begun to recognize the need for reconciliation, and this place has done pretty well about having services that allow, especially the long-term staff, to be reconciled with each other so that they can go on working and living together.
One of the things that I think it was Gertrude Lundholm said when I talked with her, and that too is in the book, whoever said it, is that while Holden is a place where interpersonal relationships can be just as difficult as anywhere else where there are people, the difference at Holden is you can't get away from each other.
That's right.
You've got to run into each other. There's no place to hide here. I think you said something like that, Gertrude.
Right.
And maybe that's why this is a place where those difficult relationships ultimately can be worked out if you stay here, or maybe you deal with it by running away. That's another possibility.
What I thought was the hardest thing and the most valuable thing staying through the winter was confrontation, which is not easy for me. But in order to exist as family, actually, you just finally have to do it, and you try to do it as differently as you can.
And when there are only 50 or 60, it's particularly hard to hide, to get away from each other. You have to deal with it.
The other side of that, too, is that as you will quickly observe, especially in the winter community, the two people that were having tension between themselves all through the week were always the very first to embrace each other during the passing of the peace.
Oh, that's great.
Because of the recognition that it's only through that kind of forgiveness and through God's grace that we really can manage to live together in the kind of intensity that this community can have sometimes.
Did that ever not happen?
Well, I didn't really keep score.
No, but I think part of that is that myth again, that it's the ideal community, it's perfect. If we have a problem, by the end of the week we'll be loving each other.
By the passing of the
again.
Peace, it'll be dealt with.
Because this is God's answer.
There were some long-standing tensions that I was aware of that never got better and got worse.
Yeah. And some went on week after week. Too.
Well, year after year, perhaps.
Yeah.
Still going.
There's a sense, too, that I think a lot of people come in with expectations that are far exaggerated. And I don't know, Gertrude and I have a classic story about this woman that came in, and by the middle of the afternoon, she was walking down Chalet Hill and said that she hadn't found Jesus yet. She expected, her expectations were that this was going to be a spiritual place that was sort of not down to reality and all that. Now, I do think that there's a sense in which our enthusiasm tends to exaggerate the expectations of people who haven't been here. And we want them to find whatever it is that they want. And it's really in work and everything else that comes. So it isn't perfect.
I think one of the things when you were talking about expectations, for me, I get a lot of vicarious enjoyment of watching people first time visitors to Oldham, but particularly over the years, people with no expectations. And usually that isn't first time visitors coming up the boat in the bus. Their expectations, they already have them. It's the hiker who has come out of the mountains, doesn't even know this place exists. And there's a story, I've seen it happen a number of times, of stumbling into the ballpark and running into a homecoming game with complete with band.
Right on the edge of a wilderness area, yeah.
And suddenly you're the Star Spangled Banner. A hiker, coming in the middle of the 4th of July parade.
Yes.
Totally blown away. Or the ones that have come in and just recently, in June, there was a group that laid over because of bad weather. Didn't even know about Holden. Attended worship, a dance, and all kinds of stuff. Got up to the portal and went nuts, Rudy. They just were having a ball. Those people will be back. And had no expectation to stumble onto that it would be living like this in the middle of the mountains or anywhere.
Yeah.
I never forget it. The first time we came here, it was in July, and we came up on the bus, and we got off the bus, and everybody was saying, Merry Christmas, and they were singing.
Was it July 25th?
Yes.
Because that's Christmas in July here, isn't it? I've never been here on that.
It was great, but it was a surprise.
Nobody warned you.
We had 2 years ago, I think it was the July 4th celebration, maybe it was 4 years ago, the last person off the second bus was going to be mayor of the day. Maybe it was Midsummer Festival. And this person got off the bus and said, Mayor for the day, I'm just here and taking the next bus back. So he passed it on to somebody else. He's going to be here for the whole day. Tourists wanted to see what this place is all about.
I have a question. You said one of the unique things about Holden is that you can't take it home with you, or that
you can't replicate it elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, why is that so unique about Holden? Isn't that unique about every place? You couldn't take, I couldn't take New York home. Or
yes. I think it is, in fact, true of every place, including the little towns in which many of us grew up. You can't replicate them either. I think people try to do it with Holden, because the experience here is so meaningful that they want to take that very same kind of community back with them, and I think that's not possible.
So they have fish teams at home?
Yeah.
Talk to people in business. Try to run a business this way.
Of course.
I've seen professional business people come up here and they look at the operation, explain how this place runs on, whatever percent volunteer labor, 90-some percent volunteer labor, and all the finances. They said, no, you can't do that. It doesn't work.
It won't work.
An expert,
yeah.
It won't work.
Yeah.
And 26 years it's been working here.
What is it Wes Creep likes to say? This place runs pretty well for a place run by 25-year-olds? That's Wes's comment. Operates pretty well for a place run by 25-year-olds.
It's also Horry's statement that if you understood this place, you'd spoil it.
Yeah, yeah, I started with that, Gertrude, before you came in. Yeah. Yeah. And the other quote that I really like is the one from Carol Hinderly that he never could understand. Why God would give a place like this to God's least imaginative people.
Speaking, of course, of Lutherans.
Yeah, the Lutherans. He said God's least imaginative people, the Lutherans. Why would God do a thing like that?
Have you ever loved this place too much?
Yeah.
How has that caused confusion, pain, joy, craziness?
There was an individual that came up here for many years. Ron Mackey was his name. And he was a big, burly, lumberjack type. And Ron had a problem. It was called alcoholism. And after he'd been up here a few times, and he went down to the Chelan area and broke up a tavern, and was brought up in front of the judge. The judge said to Ron, what am I going to do with you? You've been here before. How are we going to solve this problem? And he said, well, I found this place up in the mountains called Holden Village. And I think if you'll let me go up there, I can work out my problem. And Ron came back here, many of you know him, he came back here for several years. He'd come up in the summertime and cut all most of the wood for the village. Fantastic, phenomenal worker. He's one of these guys, he looked like he could pick up a whole log and carry it over and lay it down and chop the thing up. And he used to leave every year early, earlier than what he said he was going to stay here. And his reason was, I've got to get out of this place. I can't take the love. If some of you knew Ron, those were his words. Mm-hmm. I've got to get out of here. There's too much love around here. And then he'd come back next year. Yeah. But he was just a phenomenal guy. That's an example of.
I think the problem really comes right in that whole business of trying to export, that you want so badly to have some kind of fellowship elsewhere like this, or some kind of possibility of renewal, or even Bible studies with the hilarity that's here, that you try to do the same thing without any preparation back in your home congregation, and it's a miserable lot. I can especially remember people trying, say, some of her brokering stuff outside of it. They thought it was wacko, you know. But I think that the,
was wacko.
What you're finding out to come to is how do you get the gospel inside of you to the extent where you take into consideration where you are, wherever that is, the people that you have to work with, and try and get something going that is at least creative as things are here. You're allowing yourself and other people to be creative. I think that's something that we can learn at Holden. And you don't take the thing itself, the exact thing elsewhere, but you take the creativity and the freedom to act on that elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think many of us have seen evidence of that all over the country, and maybe beyond this country, how pieces of Holden have been adapted in places and have made a difference in worship life in local churches, in Bible study, in community life, and being able to laugh in the serious business that is being church. I think much of that has, kind of like a leaven, infected other places.
I just walked in, so I don't know too much of the context, but I think what I understand as loving Holden too much, my experience is, it comes out a couple ways. One is that I don't want Holden to make any mistakes. I want it all to be really good all the time, and everyone to love it always.
You don't want its image to be tarnished.
Not only image, but I always want to fix everything. Try to either, you know, just make everything great, always. And it takes so much energy.
It's a big burden to carry, isn't it?
The other part is I'm unwilling to let Holden change. And I always want it to stay just as wonderful as it was the first time, or maybe it was the last time I was here. Yeah. Anyway, it was really wonderful, and so it mustn't change at all, and I struggle with that, to allow an evolution to happen naturally and be part of it, have fun with the new thing.
That's where we got started on this. I was quoting Dan Erlander and saying precisely that, Anne, that one of the problems for Holden is that people love it so much they never want it to change.
Oh.
And are uncomfortable when it does evolve. But well, that's fine, because you're reinforcing the point. But what we haven't heard is from people who feel that... Yeah, I almost quoted you earlier. I'm going to tell you what I quoted you about. Whether there are people who feel that that has been their experience, that there have been changes at Holden that they really resented. You know, I wonder if anybody has that feeling. There are things that it's not quite right to do it that way, to abandon the good way, the right way. Howard.
Chuck, just a couple observations, some things that have been said when you use the word myth. one of the things that comes to mind to me is that our family spent 19 Christmases up here at the village.
Mm-hmm.
And our first Christmas here, our son was 4 years old and our daughter was 7. And 4 years later, having lived through some really neat experiences of first there were 5 of us, then there were 13, then there were 51, uh-huh. and then we went over 100 people here.
They weren't all your family.
No.
Make that clear.
That was a real geometric career.
Yeah. Prolific Gillings.
Those were productive years.
That's right. But that fourth year, when we always set the Christmas tree up in this corner. That this is where the Christmas tree has always been. And we always did on Christmas Eve, decorated Christmas afternoon, and Christmas Eve day, afternoon, and evening. And the one night I remember, the fourth year, our son was then 8 and our daughter was 11. And that's the age, as most of you parents know, that certainly at 11 your children are really suspect of Santa Claus. And an 8-year-old is getting there, but not quite. You know, they don't want to let loose of that. Well, our son is a very, something is either black or white. He has to see facts, you know. And he was just pretty sure there wasn't such a thing as Santa Claus. And we were standing about right here decorating the tree. And Horty Christman, who Chuck has mentioned, we had found here in the village in the early years a Santa Claus suit, an old Santa Claus suit from back prior to World War II that was the old red fabric with the actual sheep cloth on it, the sheep skin on it, and it was very, very authentic. And Horty Christman that year, he was a very skinny guy, and we put a lot of pillows around him and tied them on him and put on that outfit, and here we were now in the middle of the Cascades. We were the only people here. There just wasn't any of society here. And all of a sudden, coming down that upstairs hallway was this big ho, ho, ho. Oh. And Horty came to that railing and hung over the railing in that costume, ho-hoing, with a big sack of toys and whatnot, presents on the back of him, and he came downstairs. Our son was awestruck, absolutely awestruck. You have to see. I mean, he just froze, just absolutely froze. Now, there's an interesting thing that happened with all that. Our son took him years and years to realize that there was not a Santa Claus. And on top of that, yes. Remember now, we had been here for 19 years. From the time he was 4, until he was 22 going on 23. He had never Christmas shopped in the Christmas rush.
Oh, no.
Never. He has never battled that traffic. He now lives at the age of 26 in Los Angeles. If you can imagine the transition that he's gone through when it comes Christmas time.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
There's a question over here.
Behind you. Yes.
Yeah.
No. Oh, I was going to speak on behalf of mythologizing Holden. That I think that the power, and myth in the good sense, that part of the problem in exporting Holden is saying, well, part of what makes Holden is relationships and people and certain kinds of structure. But maybe we ought to say part of what makes Holden Holden is a mystical experience of this place. And you know, you talk when you use the phrase "a place apart," that's mythical language.
Mm-hmm.
And a place has power because you give it power. And when you give something power, it will give back to you that power. It sort of stores the power for you, and then you draw on that power as you need it. I think that's part of mythologizing Holden, and to do that to Holden then is to draw that power out when you need it. So I speak on behalf of more mythologizing the whole.
Re-mythologizing
the whole.
Right? There was a movement
like that. It's the contrary view for
it. Right. Here and then over here.
Me?
Yes.
Just one thing, a couple things I want to say, just as a long timer, we've been coming here maybe since about 68. And one of my frustrations always is not really taking it back home, but trying to get somebody else interested. And I've got fantastic slides and wonderful tapes of the music. And I've had people play the songs and everything, you know. And it's like, oh, that sounds good. And I'm so frustrated. I think, you know, we're so enthusiastic, and I think they think we're nuts. You know, and then once in a while, maybe 10 years later, they'll come and they'll say, wow, that's really a great place.
Why didn't you tell
me? Yeah, why didn't you tell us? I mean,
and the only other thing I would get here.
Can't the only other funny thing I wanted to tell is, what Howard didn't say is in later years, he was Santa Claus. And when we lived here, our son was about 4, and Christy Jansen was the same age, and she was terrified of Santa Claus. So Mark is on Howard's lap, and he's not too sure, but he's not going to look at it. So he's just kind of like this because he wants the present. And the discussion later is hysterical because Mark says, well, Christy, he sounds just like Howard Gilling. But he didn't really make the connection. He was an Adam Clark, so he sounds just like Howard Gilling.
I wanted to make a couple of critical observations, but I feel sort of compelled to preface this by saying my assessment of Holden in general is not critical or negative, but really enthusiastically and effusively positive. I've been on staff here for almost 2 months, and it seems like there's very little opportunity for people to share in general about what the Holden experience means to them, or to swap nostalgic stories or so forth, or general impressions. And just a criticism of the most general sort is that one result of that, I think, is that there's not enough of an opportunity or an opening for a sort of healthy self-criticism of a frequent sort, of a sort that I think would make it a healthier place. And that's natural, because if there's little occasion, maybe, you know, if your staff an opening session, an opening staff meeting, 2 or 3 small group meetings, and then a goodbye staff meeting, there's very little opportunity to say anything positive or negative about what Holden means to you. And so therefore your impulse is to be completely positive and praising of Holden in everything you say. But when those are the only sort of forums, it feels definitely inappropriate, if not ungrateful, to say anything of a critical nature about the institution. Most of these people aren't going to be here for more than a few weeks or a couple of months at most, so it's, you know, it would be difficult to say how much influence any sort of, you know, critical observations they make, you know, should have on, you know, the decision-making process. But with the title like Demythologizing Holden, I expected more criticism at a session like this than I've heard, and my overall sense of the place is that there's not much room for that.
And there isn't opportunity for that kind of sharing, generally, you're saying. You're looking for more opportunity to talk as you just did, right?
I think we need a little education about Holden down my way. You know, when it's the first time for me, and when my friends found out I was coming this way, I was told that that was a place where, for retired preachers, and I didn't even bring one home with me.
You know, part of the cult nature, the other point you did bring up, it's kind of like I was taking a walk today, and I realized, you know, am I kind of part of Holden or not part of Holden? You know, how long do you have to be here to be in? How long do you have to be here to not be in? Have you been here how many Christmases as an old time person? And then as a short termer, you know, this, you know, pegging and notching and stuff, you know. So I've been here now, you know, 5, 6 times. Is that, you know, 4 times, 5, I can't even remember, you know. Does that make me part of Holden? Or does that make me not really part of Holden because somebody's always been here longer? Is that my problem? Or is that part of that cult, you know, mystique, that kind of, especially outside of this place, it's that way too.
so open that up.
I have two things that I'd like to say. I just wanted to say how I fell in love with Holden. I came here in 1980, the first time with my family from Germany, and every day I sit at lunch and people ask me how I found out about Holden. So that was in 1980 when we wanted to visit friends of ours, that's Larry and Nyla Rasmussen, who speak here, the program director in 1980. And we wanted to visit them in Washington, but they weren't there, so we had to come up here.
Still came to Washington.
So I was 12 or 13 then, and I don't know, I couldn't really take part in everything. Everybody was laughing, and I didn't understand the jokes, and I had my little brother was there, and I had had maybe 3 years of English then in school, but he hadn't had any experience, and tried to get some companions for him who would play with him, although he didn't speak any English. And I don't know, I went home and I kept dreaming of Holden. I don't know, it came year, maybe it wasn't every night or so, it was maybe once a year I kept dreaming of Holden. And once I had that funny dream that we lived in the chalet that was on top of the hill. I think it's 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And I had that dream that there was a slide going down from that chalet right into the dining hall. Yeah. So I always thought I wanted to come back, and I decided to do that after finishing up with high school, and my parents paid for the flight, and I came out with my girlfriend, so that's how I fell in love with Holden. But speaking of love and criticism, one thing that I was talking about with a friend I made who left on Sunday was that people speak very easily about love at Holden, and we thought that it's so hard to love one person, really love somebody, but speaking of loving, really loving everybody, that seems hard to me. I think it's great if you can tolerate everybody. Right. That's already a hard thing. It can be a very hard thing. And that would be something that I think of a lot while I'm here this time. Hugging somebody when we are having Eucharist and say to him, I love you, I don't know if I say I love you to my boyfriend, I didn't do that the very first time I met him. Yeah. and just do it to somebody who sits in front of me at Eucharist is hard for me.
Yeah. Sunday, I want you to hug me and say, I tolerate you.
Carol. If we love Holden, a long tradition of the miners who lived here, because I've had the experiences many people have had of actually being in a supermarket, in my case it was in Los Angeles, with my Holden Village sweatshirt on, and somebody coming up and saying, where did you get that sweatshirt? And I said, well, it's this place in Washington. And it turns out that they lived here, and they grew up here during mine days, and they loved this place. They're still talking about it. Mm-hmm.
I would like to mention one other thing. It's part of the cult nature, I think, of Holden, both here and among Holdenites outside. There's a conventional wisdom at Holden, as there is probably everywhere. There's a conventional line, and you very quickly discover what it is. And the best way for me to talk about it is in terms of politics.
Yeah.
There is a political conventional wisdom here, which I'm relatively comfortable with. But I imagine this must be a very uncomfortable place for a Reagan Republican to spend very much time. I'm sure there have been some here, maybe some in the room tonight. But that is not the conventional wisdom of Holden Village, Reagan Republicanism. I think, for example, for someone to come here and say good things about, or bad things about the Sandinistas is somewhat, that's a little bit like passing gas in church. I mean, you don't do that more. It's not the conventional wisdom here. And that troubles me a little bit, even though the politics of Holden is basically congenial to my politics. But I think that's a problem Holden has, and I know that people on program planning wrestle with it, try and bring in differing viewpoints. But there is something that has grown up about the Holden political content that is not only here, but among Holdenites wherever they are. I don't know why that is, but it is. And I think it's another piece of what I would call a criticism of the place, that at least it's something we need to be aware of if we want to be inclusive. Holden talks a lot about inclusiveness, but I don't know that we've succeeded in being really inclusive in terms of political thought.
And also of races. You know, we have the rainbow, the two groups of rainbow.
Obviously, we're pretty middle class and pretty white, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty mono-cultured, educational, economic kind of group.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's anything that you feel about when you say you belong to this cult and somebody's been here longer than you have, I think the significance of that to me is that the longer you've been here, the more you have witnessed change. And you've accepted it, you've gone along with it. You've sat in on the discussions. We can talk now about maybe the uncomfortableness of a political sphere of a Reagan Republican, but I can remember with Elmer Witt, for example, sitting in this room with two other youth directors, and we were having open forum talks with teenagers about the conflict between teenagers and adults. And I can remember how some of those teenagers spoke up and chastised their parents in this room. And we got into real Donnybrook, shouting matches back and forth. That was uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But it brought a lot of things together. So I don't think, I think that changes whatever there is that you feel a restriction of, that changes with the time. We go through cycles.
And I suppose those who are really uncomfortable with the changes stop coming. It's too uncomfortable for them.
Sure.
I think the education that Holden does on educating people about political issues is one of the very best things that it does. And I hate to see it change or slacken or become any, or tame its message on any of those points because, I'm doing a Matins on Friday and I was planning to talk about this issue, but I did one before and I used the phrase jacuzzi of cozy self-congratulation. I was talking about Joe, but that's a sort of thing that I see a lot of Holden visitors, maybe guests more than staff, but staff too, sort of sliding into at times. And one of the best things about Holden, I think, is that, and you know, if we're only here for a week or 2 weeks or a month, we don't necessarily get a sense of the place as a community. But one of the best ways I think that Holden exports or communicates to people its vision of community, not only of this community but of the larger community, is through the education that it does on and advocacy that it does on political issues. And I think that can be a very challenging experience for maybe many people who just come here, you know, to snap a few pictures and, you know, take in some nice views and then go home. So I find that a very praiseworthy aspect of
it. How'd you feel about it? That there were mostly Reagan people that did the leadership of that.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
If the agenda here were right of center rather than left of center, would you feel the same way?
Well, I'm from Texas, where on the whole, Protestant denominations probably would be more inclined to be Reagan-type political activists than Democrats. I certainly, you know, would question the assertion that God is a Democrat. I don't think he's probably registered in either party for this question.
Is Jim and Tammy Baker still looking for a job?
We have an opening.
How many of us would be uncomfortable?
Then we get that water stuff if Jim and Tammy Baker were here. Yeah.
How many of you would be uncomfortable if we had a more of a
Reagan platform.
More comedy or
it doesn't fit the Christianity.
To my point of view.
I'm always comfortable when it agrees with me. Or when it beats me. And it does agrees but still challenges.
Yeah, what you just said, I think it's good to have that political education in terms of getting informed about things. But I think it's only good if the people get an idea of things here and try to inform them much more about the things when they get home. Because if they stay with the idea that they get home, it will be one side they hear about it. And that's the Reagan Democrats thing, you know? You always have to see both sides to get your position. And if you only hear one person's side by listening to his opinions for 1 week and then go home and think that's the whole thing about it, that won't be good either.
You wouldn't believe how many times as village philosopher here I've talked to people to try to see if they might want to share one of their opinions here publicly, because it goes kind of against the Holden mystique. Because it's always easy to find one side, it's the other side that's very difficult. Yeah. And there's a lot of you people out there that go against kind of what is typically Holden, but to present it in some sort of way here, knowing the Holden mystique, he says, what do you think I am, crazy?
Yeah,
it's so hard.
It's very intimidating to go against the conventional wisdom of any place, including this place, I think.
I don't know what this typical Holden mystique you're talking about. I have not found that yet. I'm still looking for it.
Howard, what I was referring to, at least in terms of political content, is an agenda that is well to the left of center on just about every issue. And I think that showed up in the forum on platform the other night. What everybody spoke in favor of was a platform well to the left of the present Democratic Party platform in this country. And I think that's the conventional Holden political line. And I say I'm fairly comfortable with it. That's where I am myself. But I am concerned about those others in our churches who don't share that view and who also should have a place at Holden. And some of them find their way here, and I'm not sure how they feel. So they're reluctant to speak up.
I speak up. I feel quite comfortable here, and I'm certainly not anywhere near, evidently, where you are. But I certainly feel comfortable. And,
well, good.
I'm enjoying it. It's my first time here, and I've only been here a day.
He will get you on the floor later.
I may not feel comfortable at all.
Over here and over.
Yeah, I guess I want to speak up for not necessarily being apologetic for taking a particular political side. I think the gospel calls us to that. And I think that doesn't mean that we shouldn't always be humble in that and recognize that we don't all have the truth. And I realize that, and I don't want what I'm going to say to sound like some very elitist, sort of narrowly left position on things. But I really do believe that what I think we should be about is trying to provide an alternative viewpoint to the news and the perspective that most of our culture gets. I really do believe that the Christian community is called to be a countercultural community in this particular day and age. And so I really do believe that we should not be apologetic about trying to speak prophetically. And I think that in this particular time, that means in most cases to be left of center. I do think that what we need to be then careful of is how do we create an atmosphere where people still can dialogue about those things. That we don't present it in a way in which it is, where there's no true invitation to dialogue that's invited. But I think that's different than automatically thinking that every time we present an issue, we have to present the other side. I do not believe that that's that's what we need to be doing here. I think we should be challenging the more dominant.
We have about 5 minutes left over here.
As Perry mentioned, dialogue. Sometimes I think we have two monologues here because I represent the conservative side of the board, possibly, and the conservative side of the whole picture. And I very often used to feel uncomfortable in the village because we only had one side of the picture. And I still do occasionally, but now I've learned to feel kind of sorry for some of the people who sit on the other side and have not had a chance to enlarge their comfort zone. Each year I can come up here and listen to a liberal side and enlarge my comfort zone a little bit. I don't know whether you guys go to the Republican convention to get your comfort zone enlarged or whatever.
We're here this week.
I like it. Yeah.
But I certainly can empathize with the people who do feel that they're getting one side of the story, because it's a little intimidating for two strong people to sit up there and say, anybody want to come up here and have a dialogue with us, you know. So, but I speaking now to those people who feel uncomfortable in this situation, as one who has felt uncomfortable in the village from time to time, I do think it is a good place to enlarge the comfort zone. And that doesn't mean that you have to say that I'm accepting all of this, but I now feel comfortable listening to the dialogue. Monologue, excuse me.
No. Anybody have a another closing comment of some sort?
I got a funny closing comment. Okay. We've been here through all three directors and watched a lot of change, but as long as West Freeb does the dead dying soldier, Holden is alive.
On that note, thank you so much, and let's go and keep and remember that lights are going to be out in an hour for us.